Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is national best-selling author Lisa Wingate. Lisa and I will be discussing her latest release, The Prayer Box. It is a book that celebrates the untold stories of hope, wishes, fear, and love. Good morning, Lisa. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm doing actually great this morning. It's kind of a treat on an ordinary Tuesday to get to talk to real people instead of just sitting around with my imaginary friends writing.
Interesting. Great. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. The Prayer Box, which is your 20th book, is a wonderful inspirational fiction. It is a beautifully written novel. Thanks for taking us on a journey that engages the heart, mind, soul, and spirit. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was a very special book for me. They all are, but this one was kind of special in a number of ways for me.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. I'm the youngest in the family. The only girl, so I grew up with two older brothers, so I have sympathy for anybody else who found themselves growing up in that situation. It is not easy to be the youngest and the only girl. But, you know, I had a great childhood. I grew up, we moved around a lot, which was hard for me because I was a pretty shy kid. But, you know, we lived in these neighborhoods at the tail end of that time when every house had a mom in it, and we pretty much left the house after breakfast, and we wandered the neighborhood, and, you know, if you got hungry, if it was lunchtime, you just went into somebody's house, and the mom there would feed you, and if you were thirsty, she had Kool-Aid, and that was pretty much, people lived in three-bedroom, one-story houses pretty much, and moms, you know, a lot of families didn't have two cars, so maybe the mom only had the car if it was carpool day for her. And that's how I grew up. You know, people didn't worry about us as long as we were home by the time the streetlights came on. It was all good. And we just wandered and we made up things and we played Let's Pretend. And that's the kind of childhood I had, you know, and kind of moved around a lot, so we got to know a lot of different places and make a lot of different friends.
Interesting. That sort of epitomized the idea of it takes a little village to raise a child, because you have all these many mothers and brothers looking out for you in the neighborhood.
We did. We, you know, one thing we knew how to kind of, we knew how to rely on other people because we did it so much. You didn't go knock on people's front doors. You just sort of went around back and went into people's houses. And it was kind of like Lucy and Ethel on I Love Lucy. It was all very casual and relaxed. And we knew the people in our neighborhood really well. And life was just comfortable, and we knew how to scare up a game of tag or touch football. And there was nothing on TV back then other than Saturday morning that a kid wanted to watch.
Right.
So we learned how to entertain ourselves. And, yeah, we learned a lot about people and different families and different people's lives.
That's a lot more greater connection, I presume, with the neighbors, your friends, parents, in a sense, from that perspective. And also just being able to kind of travel around the neighborhood a whole lot more compared to, say, right now, where we are kind of boxed in our own home, pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's a big cultural shift that I've seen in my lifetime. And sort of a sad cultural shift in a way. The people I grew up with, when you think about it, they grew up in the time before houses had air conditioning and whatnot. So people were outdoors a lot, especially when the weather was hot. And houses were set up with front porches, and you came and went from the front of your house, and so you saw your neighbors. And that the neighborhoods were still that way when I was young, but what was happening was things were starting to change. You know, television was becoming the center of family life, and houses were air-conditioned, and so people, and the houses were being built then in the 60s and 70s, the houses were being built. And you think about what happened to houses sort of signifies what happened to life in a neighborhood. You know, the porches were all chopped off the front of the houses, and the windows were made smaller, and because sort of that was the style in those ranch-style type houses that were built in that era. But I think I look at them sometimes, and I think of what that signifies, of the cultural change that signifies in breaking those connections to your neighbors. And now you think of neighborhoods, and we don't even, in a lot of neighborhoods, come and go from the front of our houses anymore. You know, we come and go from a back alley where we literally don't see anybody.
Right, right. During your time growing up, when did you realize you enjoy writing?
You know, I think I was always a writer in some way, because that was kind of what we did back then. We went out and we played Let's Pretend, and we didn't have any concept of private property rights, so every empty field was our forest kingdom or whatever we wanted it to be that day. And we lived a couple times along small creeks, and so we would gather our backpacks and we would journey down these creeks, and we would be so sure that we were so far away from home we would maybe never find our way back before dark, you know. And then you hear, because that was before cell phones, so back then the moms just stepped out the back door and hollered at supper time. And, you know, you'd hear somebody's mom calling, and we'd climb up out of this creek valley and realize we were still in somebody's backyard. But that was life. So I think I always was a storyteller and a writer. The first time I ever that idea kind of came into my mind, or I ever had that desire to actually write things down, I had an older brother who was a great writer, and I must have been about five or so. He taught me to read and write before I started school, but he came home anyway from school, and he had this poem he had written, and I remember that scene so well. It was sort of a Brady Bunch kind of scene, because I remember him standing up in the living room with that poem and starting to read it, and I remember my father lowered his newspaper, and all the adults stopped to watch my brother, and I think I heard Angel Song somewhere off in the distance as he read this poem about the bee went under the sea, and it was all about this bumblebee who went underwater somehow and experienced the undersea world. And and I remember there was a blue ribbon dangling off that paper, and so that I was hooked after that. I ran to my bedroom and wrote my first book.
Fantastic. That's wonderful news. Were you following authors at that time as well? Were there some authors that inspired you?
There were books that inspired me. I was kind of a horse-crazy little kid. A horse or pony was on my Christmas list every year from the time I could write a Christmas list. And so I was very into any book that had horses in it. And but, you know, there were lessons I learned from those books, too, because a lot of those stories were about the friendship that existed between the child and the pony, and the adventures they had together. And, you know, I think this taught me the value of having friends and of being loyal to your friends. There was, you know, the animal stories, there's all this great loyalty between the animal and the person, and So I think those things inspired me as a kid.
That's interesting. What's good about the animal analogy is that you have cats and dogs getting together, and so are all the other animals. They're all friends. It's not all of the same kind of animals.
That is true. You know, and I think we have a lot to learn from the way animals are so accepting of people and of differences, and, you know, really, really all a dog or a cat or whatever wants is your attention and your love.
Yeah. Right.
They don't,
right.
They're not conditional with it.
That's right. What sort of stories eventually interest you most?
Really, as a young reader, and I find this also when I read things written by young kids, kids like things that are very dramatic and very heartrending and really explore these big, big emotions, because I think as young people, you know, that's what we're doing. We're exploring our emotions, and we're trying to figure out life and who we're going to be and what matters. And so I was very into things like Where the Red Fern Grows and The Black Stallion and all of Marguerite Henry's books, because they had horses in them. But also, you know, because they were always about these big dramas, and that to me was what was interesting. And as I got a little older, you know, I was a little more into things like Mark Twain and Gone with the Wind and Little Women, and a little more things that are kind of more into that, push into that teenage realm or whatever. But I think I was always interested in stories because I was always interested in the bigger questions that they explored.
Do you daydream a whole lot?
Yes, I do. I have to say I do, and I always have. One of my favorite daydream memories is having a geometry teacher in the 10th grade tell me to stop that daydreaming and pay attention in geometry, because you'll need this one day, and there's no future in writing stories. So it's kind of funny to remember that now. I'm sure he just wanted me to pay attention in geometry, but I have never used geometry since then.
Well, you could, though. In your next book, you can just always write down, this is a story about how X plus Y equals Z.
It could be. I may need
That's
it
right.
someday.
Right, right. And then you go spend a whole paragraph about the essence of X, the essence of Y, and why it gets to Z.
There you go.
Do you write to express yourself or to entertain others?
I think I write for both reasons. And I kind of think I always did. I mean, there was writing when I was younger that was sort of just for me, but mostly I think I always had in mind an audience for it. For me, it was a way to work out things in life, maybe things I was confused by or didn't like, or, you know, the beauty of a story is you can take situations you can't fix in life, and you can put them in a story, and you can fix things, and you can open people's eyes, and you can make people see the things that you sometimes can't talk them into in real life. So, you know, I think, I did always have it in mind as a career. And so, you know, there is always thinking about, you know, how will this be for the reader, and is it entertaining, and does the story move along, and that's part of the business of writing. And I think to remain employed in writing, you have to be able to separate the two. You have to be able to then look and analyze and think, you know, does this have larger value to people who would read it, or is this just something I'm interested in or something, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. more that's only of interest to me.
Right, right. Well, you started writing articles, and then you wrote, I presume, short stories and so forth, and then you became a full-fledged author. What life's epiphanies moved you to become an author?
You know, I think just always been that way. I just can't remember not wanting to write and tell stories and mm-hmm. live stories. And I think I always, as a kid, I got so deeply into the stories, and they lived mm-hmm. with me afterward, mm-hmm. and I just loved that feeling of
yeah.
living all these other lives. And, you know, I think I just had an innate sense of that very young. And it's fascinating to me now because the latest brain science,
mm-hmm.
they've done the thing with the diodes on the brain and all that. And, you know, they can map the fact that if you read about an experience, your same parts of your brain are lighting up as if you were doing that. So if you read about mm-hmm. swimming, your brain is lighting up as if you were diving into a pool. And
mm-hmm.
that, I think I always felt that. It's nice to see science confirm it now.
Yeah.
But I always just loved that feeling.
Very interesting. So how has writing for the Christian readers different from writing for the mainstream market?
Well, as you know, I do both. I've written on mm-hmm. both sides of the market, and my stuff kind of tends to cross over between Christian and mainstream. And specifically, so there isn't a lot of difference in my stuff that's written for the Christian or the mainstream market, but there are some differences. I think there's an expectation when you're writing for the Christian market, you can deal with gritty subjects and you can mm-hmm. deal with a lot of tough reality. There's an expectation that the novels will not be graphic. And sometimes that can be hard to do when you're dealing with gritty subjects. You know, it requires a little extra level of thought to keep the books more on a level where they're not graphic. But mm-hmm. I think there's also value to that because a lot of the mainstream market has gone more and more toward, you know, very, very graphic stuff. And there mm-hmm. are a lot of readers who just don't have an appetite for that. And so Christian writing in the Christian or the inspirational market, I think, satisfies that audience. And also, of course, in a Christian novel, you're not just exploring the character's physical journey, but you're really mm-hmm. exploring mm-hmm. the character's spiritual journey from point A at the beginning of the story when things are just not authentic and right mm-hmm. spiritually, to a place where the character can live as an authentic mind and heart and body in the world. And mm-hmm. to me, mm-hmm. that's the deeper thread of every story, and part of the reason I like writing stories where faith is intertwined, because you write from where you live, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm a person of faith, and I live in the South, and, you know, we all get up on Sunday and go to church, so that's just where I live.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's a very natural place for me to write from.
That's wonderful. Who or what influenced your writing most?
My writing, I think, is mostly influenced by life.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
mm-hmm.
there's not a single writer I can point to and say, this writer inspired me, or a single mentor I can point to. I mean, I had mentors over the years in writing, but mm-hmm. I think I was most inspired by life. I was inspired by that idea of stepping into the mind and heart and body and soul of another person and what you could accomplish with that. Because part of the reason, when you don't like somebody that mm-hmm. you meet or see or who lives in the world with you, or who looks different from you or whatever. A lot of times it's because you don't know where that person is coming from. You
mm-hmm.
don't understand what it is to their settled Cherokee proverb, you know, never criticize your neighbor until you've walked a mile in his moccasins.
Right, right.
And writing stories are the chance to do that. And when you understand where someone else is coming from, why we're all a product of a set of experiences that we've had through life, and what the way we see things, the way we feel about things
mm-hmm.
is all a product of those experiences. Nobody's objective. We're all looking through this colored glass.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, writing is the opportunity to show, you know, what does the world look like through somebody else's eyes? Why
mm-hmm.
does it look that way? And then hopefully, you know, when you've lived in the shoes of a kid who's run away from a bad foster care situation and is trying to survive on the street, then maybe you have a different level of sympathy for that situation when you come across someone in life who's been in
mm-hmm.
that situation or who is in that situation, you know, or when you've lived in the shoes of a woman who's trying to deal with the grief of old age after, the family has moved on and the husband is gone and she's alone
mm-hmm.
in this big house, you know, maybe you have more sympathy for someone in that situation. Maybe you look across the street and see if you have a neighbor out there like that, if there's someone you can touch who's in that situation because you understand it now.
Right, right, right. And the driving force in all the things that we do in life, in so many ways, when you look at things, is that we are governed by two equal but separate forces, love and fear. So we can look at things through the lens of love, and we perceive and see things differently from when we look at things through the lens of fear. That, in some ways, will affect our thought process and eventually our actions based on what we see.
That is so true. That is, I think that battle between
mm-hmm.
love and fear is the ultimate battle in life. It's the
mm-hmm.
ultimate decision, because those two things repel each other like oil and water. They
yeah.
don't exist in the same space.
Right. And yet we are in a situation that we have a choice. We're given the choice. So sometimes we have to approach it from the standpoint of, if we come across from the angle of looking through things through the lens of love, then we give that person the benefit of the doubt, in the sense of what my mom always tells me, that people always set out to do things right, but in the course of doing things right, they may not do the right thing. There are always exceptions to that rule now, but usually that pretty much tells it all.
That's true.
The right decisions. Yeah, we don't make the right decisions. What is the motivation behind the prayer box?
The motivation behind the prayer box, where the idea kind of sprung from, because for me, every story always springs from some what if.
Mm.
And I never know where that's going to come from, but I was actually sitting down conceiving some book ideas at a publisher's request, and so I was going through my scrap drawer where I have restaurant napkins and you know, scraps of paper and junk that I've written the ideas on. And I was coming up with ideas, and I just looked across my room, and I saw this prayer box that had been given to me by a group where I went to speak and years ago. And I thought, and all of a sudden, the story just began to tumble in my mind, and I thought, you know, what if somebody kept those over the course of a lifetime? And what if there were many of them? And I saw this closet with these 81 prayer boxes in this old house, and this menagerie of prayer boxes, and all different and all decorated differently and representing the years of the life of this owner of the house. And, and I just started thinking, what would be in there? What story would those tell? What's more true to who we are than what we pray for? And so that really was the genesis of this story, was looking at that prayer box and thinking, you know, what if the prayers of your lifetime were recorded, and what if somebody found them?
Very interesting. Please give us a synopsis of the book.
So, yeah, the synopsis of the book, basically, the story is, it's about the life, this very unsung life, that is recorded in these prayer boxes, one kept for every year, 81 years of this woman's life, so from the time she's 10 until the time she passes away at 91 in her house, she has kept these prayer boxes. The story is really about this young woman who comes there and finds them. She's tasked with cleaning out the house, and she finds these prayer boxes, and it's about how the lessons that she learns from them. I mean, it's about her uncovering the mystery of the life of this woman who lived in the house, this very difficult life, and how this woman reacted to it. Mm-hmm. But it's also the story of how that woman's life, how her story changes the life of the young woman who finds these prayer boxes.
Very interesting.
That was not one sentence.
That was a wonderful description of the book. I enjoyed reading the book, and I did not know what to expect the first time when I picked the book up, because, okay, prayer box is really cool. This is a story about prayers, basically. And it is about prayers. What I got out of the whole concept is the fact that prayers are actually pit stops in our lives. Those are those markers in life that it really challenges us. I'm not saying that we don't pray 2-3 times a day now, but I'm talking about the really, really heavy stuff that we do. Those pit stops in our life's journey. What has happened in the book is that it shows you walk us through this journey of the two individuals in the book. Well, I mean, more than that, but it's just the fact that it gives us an opportunity to reflect back on our life and say, you know, when was the time that I did my little prayer thing, this pit stop? At least that's my take on the book.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. You know, that's one of the things about prayer journaling or prayer boxing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we toss a lot of prayers out there, and we sort of, over the course of a day, and we sort of scattershot them, and we sort of forget them and move on. And, you know, the value to having those things written as they are, Iola Poole's prayers are written and they're contained in those boxes, is it is the chronicle of your life. You know, when you care enough about something, when you're motivated enough by it, either whether it's the joy of blessing or the agony of, you know, grief or desperation, when you're motivated enough by it that you would take the time to pour it out of your soul onto paper, it is a pit stop in your life, you know, and especially if those prayers are going to God, that, you know, that's a major moment in your life when you would take the time to do that. And we probably in our lives remember a few of those.
Right.
When we were just really on our knees about something, or when we were so overjoyed with blessing, we just felt the need to offer it up. But the beauty of Iola Poole and her prayer boxes and of prayer journaling or prayer boxing is that many of these things that we maybe would not remember later are then remembered in the writing.
It's a wonderful, what I consider as living biography in so many ways, because those are those captured moments at that point in time in life.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what they are. And yeah, you're the pit stop is a great analogy for it, because that's kind of what a prayer is. It's when you slide off the road of life for a minute and focus. And these are these little focus points in this woman's very complicated life.
I may have more prayer boxes than she does, though. How did you come up with the various characters?
They sort of, some stories I really work for, and some stories sort of tumble in. And this really was a story that sort of came tumbling in all at once. I knew a lot about this old woman who lived in the house, and I knew that she would be a woman who had lived a very complicated and tough life, and that she was dealing with what it was like to be interracial at a time, you know, when it was not an accepted thing to be neither black nor white.
Right.
And growing up from, you know, the 20s on, that she had gone through the very difficult stages of finding her place in the world. And the young woman, I knew that the person who came to this house would be someone who had a very a tough life also, and a life that in some ways mirrored the life of the older woman, but was a little more modern, a little more dealing with modern issues. Mm-hmm. And she's a bit of an homage. Tandy, the young woman in the book, is a bit of an homage to, I teach high school seniors in Sunday school and have for many, many years. And so I go through this every year. We go through this last defining year with them. And we have kids from all different backgrounds because we're the big church in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these kids come from really tough lives, and some of them come from really great lives. And some of the ones that come from tough lives, you know that when they exit that Sunday school class, we try everything we can to get them on the right path. But some of you know they're not headed on the right path at that point.
Right.
And what you really hope is that you maybe have planted a seed, and at some point in their life, something comes along or someone comes along that, even if they've gone through many missteps and they've fallen down many times and they've messed up their lives, that you've maybe shown them a little bit of what normal is, and someone's going to come along and reinforce that at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tandy is really, she's one of those kids, you know, that we've had to turn loose of it at the end of Sunday school in the 12th grade and send out into the world, and she hasn't done the right things, and she hasn't, you know, what we learn growing up is our default, and it's very, very hard to break away from that. And she's someone who keeps going back to default, even though she hated default. She grew up in a terrible family and had a terrible life situation, and the letters in those prayer boxes, the life that's left behind in this house is finally the thing that's her turning point. So, you know, I sort of, that's where her character came from.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, as you had mentioned just now, we go through life based on the default of the way we used to. And basically, that's natural because we are creatures of comfort. So that's our comfort zone. And what the prayer box offered is that a roadmap, that's something different. Someone who has blazed the trail before you. And, of course, you have to take the steps yourself to make it happen.
Right.
Were there challenges in writing the book?
There always are. In every book, there's always something that, because I don't really plan the books ahead. I mean, I had, you know, a broad vision of the story and how it would go, but I don't sit down and plan scene by scene or anything. And so I always know as I'm writing the first part that there is something I'm avoiding getting to. And in this book, I knew pretty early on that what I was avoiding getting to was Iola's actual prayer letters. You know, what did they look like? What was in them? How did she phrase them? How did she write them? What was her voice? And because it felt like a big responsibility to take on someone's prayers. And I know it's not really someone's prayers because she's not real, but they're very, very real to me, all these people.
Sure.
And so, you know, it felt like really taking on someone's prayers and after the person has passed away. And so that was the difficult part. And I knew I was avoiding it, and then when I finally got to, because I was afraid of it, and then when I finally got to that day, the voice of Iola Ann Poole, this tiny woman who lived all her life in this house, sort of quietly and sweetly in the background of her community, just came pouring out, and I knew who she was and what she had to say to the world after she was gone.
Well, your writing certainly showed that you were spiritually guided to write those prayers.
Yes, it definitely was. I mean, every story to me is a divine inspiration, and it comes from God. And sometimes you wrestle with how to tell it or whatever. But Iola's life, I didn't wrestle with it all. I mean, it came from God. It was just, it was as if she had really lived and she was there telling me her story.
Mm-hmm. Did you do much research for the book?
I did do quite a bit of research. I didn't start out to. Originally, I was going to set it on the Texas coast. I knew the house would be hurricane ravaged because it mirrors the condition of the character who comes there. And so I was going to set it on the Texas coast. We've got family down on the coast, and we've lost beach houses and had houses damaged and all that sort of thing. And so that would have been very easy for me. But a friend of mine, a longtime reader friend, got in contact with me and said, you know, he'd been up to the Outer Banks right after Hurricane Irene, and he was so distraught about the condition of things there. And he said, you know, because it didn't hit New York City, everybody's acting like it was a non-event, but the Outer Banks are a wreck. And Outer Banks of North Carolina, Hatteras Island and that area. And, you know, he said, you need to set a book there. And I emailed him back, and I said, you know, well, I'll put that on my list of things to think about. And he was very determined anyway. He then got in touch with his daughter and asked if I wanted to set a book there, could Lisa come stay in the beach house? And so then he got in touch with me and said, you know, if you want to set a book there, you can come stay in the beach house. And, I mean, so who wouldn't have a brilliant idea after an offer like that? So that's how the book ended up being set on the Outer Banks, and I did go there and spend time and meet the people and learn the area and see what they had been through. We were there the next spring after Hurricane Irene, so, you know, like 9 months or so, about the time period that's taking place in the story. And, you know, we just learned all these people had been through and what it's like to go through a massive storm like that and then clean back up. And so, you know, we did a lot of research on the islands and the history and these very, very rugged people who live there. And it's such a beautiful area, and it's got so much history, and it added so much to the story. It added a lot of research because you're learning an area you don't know, but it added so much color and life to the story. And then, of course, Hurricane Sandy happened as the book was already in production, so that was interesting.
Do you use a prayer box yourself?
I do use a prayer box myself. I have ever since one was given to me. What I found when I had prayer journaled for years and taught classes on prayer journaling and all that sort of thing. But what I found with the prayer box is that it's so much more low pressure. You know, prayer journaling sort of implies that you're supposed to really sit down and think out and write these grand things and be very organized. And a prayer box, you know, literally the back of a shopping list will do. You know, anywhere you are, as long as you've got some paper, if something is, you know, bothering you or you see something you need to pray for or there's something that you're just obsessing over, you can jot it down, and then when you get home, you can put it in your prayer box. And so it's, for me, a very functional form of written prayer.
Very interesting. So I presume you are an advocate to have a prayer box then.
I definitely am. A prayer box is, it's very therapeutic. There's something about writing something down that sort of expunges it from your soul or takes the responsibility away from you. Or if it, you know, it's great to write down your blessings too, and in that case you're sort of confirming them in a way. And it forces you to think through things a little bit. And putting it inside and closing the lid is really, it's very symbolic of giving it away and letting it go and letting God have it and having confidence that, that God does have it and you, you know, you can move on from there. And so I think it's therapeutically in life, they have tremendous value.
So true. And by the way, for all the young listeners, I'm sure you are advocating to use more than 140 characters to do this.
Yes. It does not have to be a tweet. You don't have to tweet, God. You can write as much as you need to. Yeah. I think we do get kind of used to sound bites in our lives, and it's good to sit down and take a little more time than that to get your thoughts together.
Interesting. How much of you is in the book?
I think you always write from where you come from. Mm-hmm. You're always interested in the things that concern you or that bother you or that you wish you could change in the world or whatever. And so there's some of me in the book. I've never lived through a hurricane, although, like I said, we are, being in Central Texas, we're always the recipient of our coastal relatives who come on hurricanes when there's an evacuation going on. So we've lived through that process of kind of watching your life be wrecked and having to recover. And, you know, we've all been through that. It may not be because of a hurricane or a natural disaster, but we've all been through, in some way, an illness, a death, something, that process of having your life wrecked and realizing you need something you can't provide for yourself. And this is why God puts other people in our lives. This is why he puts us in other people's lives, because we have something we need or we have something we can give. And that's the concept in the book of the grace water that Iola sees as she sees in her lifetime, of course, that area recovering from many, many storms, because that's the way it is on the Outer Banks. You know, and she sees that life is all this process of the grace water, and it's flowing under you sort of like this underground river that bubbles up here and there. And, you know, and sometimes you need to drink of the grace water and someone else has provided it. And sometimes you're the one to pour out the grace water into someone else's life. And that's when we as human beings are at our best. That, you know, in tragedy, difficulty brings out two things in us. It brings out our desire and ability and need to give, and it brings out our humility to be able to take. And that's, I think, what is in me of the book, is the understanding of that giving and taking of grace in life.
So true. And it's very difficult to humble yourself to receive, especially when you enjoy so much in giving.
Yeah, it is. I think I ask that question a lot, teaching classes and things. And I think we're probably about 80% or so to say it's much harder for me to accept than to give. It's much easier for me to be the giver and the provider than it is to be the one in need.
Yeah, so true. Who should read the book?
You know, I think it's a book for just about everyone, and that has been one of the things, you know, the title makes it sound maybe like it's a book for people who are very, very traditionally religious, but really 90% of the public says they believe in prayer. About 40 to 50% actually attend a church regularly. And so there's a vast number of people who, for whom prayer is part of life. They believe in it. They may not necessarily be traditionally churched. So this book is sort of for the 40% who are traditionally churched, but also for that other percentage who are not traditionally churched, but who understand prayer and who want to understand it better, you know, who want to understand how that functions in a life and what a difference that can make in a life, because that's really, that's what Iola's example is. You know, it's an example of reacting differently to life. Iola and Tandy, the old woman and the young woman in the book, are parallels of each other in many ways, but their ways of reacting to their circumstances are so different. And Iola's way of reacting to it with prayer and with turning it over and with learning to be content makes her life so much more rich, even in spite of its difficult circumstances. So I think the book is for everyone who's looking for that answer.
Mm-hmm. I agree. You're right in terms of maybe you're thinking that, oh my gosh, I mean, this is just for people that prays every day. But I think it goes beyond that. The book truly speaks about there are so many times, moments in our lives that we have those pit stops, those major things. Sometimes we tend to forget that we had those pit stops in life. And what this mm-hmm. book does is that it reminds us, that's right, this happened to me, and I remember doing this, I remember doing that. And those, again, I'm reverting back to the idea of the living biography, because those are the epiphanies of life that we went through. Those are the times that we have those paradigm shifts. Good or bad or whatever, it's irrelevant, but it's those moments in time that we really sort of focus and understand the meaning of life, the meaning of faith, and the understanding of the fact that we can't do it all and we need something bigger than us to help us to accomplish this.
Right. Exactly. And, I think we tend to, it's sort of like after a person dies, we tend mm-hmm. to gloss over all the difficult parts of that personality and make it better than it was. You know, we
right.
tend to do that with the past, too.
Right.
We tend
right.
to gloss over it and make it better than it was. And part of the beauty of, looking at Iola's life and her past and looking at our own past honestly is, we do realize, we've had these paradigm shifts. Yeah, we've been through tough things before and we've come out of it. And there's value to that when you're going through tough things now.
Sure, definitely. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading The Prayer Box?
There's always in every story a thing, an underlying message to it, and I never know what it's going to be exactly, but sometime during the writing of it, something will happen that identifies the message for me. And for me, the message of this book was identified during a weekend of working with the kids at our church. It was a big weekend where they all stay in host homes and with kids of their grade level and everything. And anyway, I walked into the back of the church and there was a little girl sitting there by herself, pouting, looking very unhappy, middle school girl. And I sat down beside her and I said, how come you're sitting out here? You're not in with the kids. And she said, oh, it's all just fake. Here we are learning how not to be fake. And all these girls will talk to me here, and when I get to school, they won't even talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to go home. And so I looked down, and there on the chair between us was her purse, and it was sort of spilled. And so I picked up her cell phone, and I said, what? If I walked by and took this, what would you do? And she said, well, I'd stop you. My life is in that phone. And so I set it down. I picked up her lip gloss, and I asked her how much it cost, and she said $1.50, and I said, if I walked by and grabbed this, or those girls you're so worried about, if they walked by and grabbed this, what would you do? And she said, well, I'd jump them. And mm-hmm. I said, why would you jump somebody over $1.50 lip gloss? And
yeah.
she said, because it's mine, it's not theirs. And I said, exactly, that's the thing. Your faith in you, your faith in God is yours, it's not somebody else's. And you have to protect it with at least as much vigor as you would protect your little belongings in your purse. And so mm-hmm. to me, that's the underlying message of the book. You have to own your own faith. You have to own who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. It's a beautiful message for everyone. How can the prayer box be used to help enrich lives of our loved ones?
Oh, I love to give them as gifts. You can use it, of course, as in the book, to leave a record of
mm-hmm.
your own life for the
mm-hmm.
people who come after you. But a prayer box can go almost anywhere a greeting card can go. It's a great thing to give to someone who, for bereavement, if someone is working through a death, it's a great place for them to be able to leave their thoughts. It's a great thing. I love to give them for weddings, and I send along a note explaining to the couple what it's for, and I say, you know, your first year of marriage, write down three things about each other every day that you're grateful for, and put it in the box, and then at the end of the year, put it away and get it out again someday in the future, because what great training to learn, you know, that first year of marriage to actively appreciate each other each day.
Right.
I love to give them when a baby's born, you know, and I tell the mother, write down your prayers and have grandma and everybody write down their prayers and hopes for this baby and then save it. I give them for Christmas and I'll tell families, write down what you're praying for in the next year and then pack this away with your Christmas junk and, you know, then get it out next year and see what's happened with those prayers and those wishes. You know, do they still matter? Did they come true? Were they answered in a different way? There just are so many ways prayer boxes are great within a family. Also a great family communication thing between parents and children to let them know you're actively praying for the things that they are dealing with.
Right, right. I would add also, sometimes in the moment of the prayer, in this case in the present moment, it may not mean a whole lot. Of course it does, but it does not mean as much as, say, sometime in the future, looking back, and when you pick up that prayer box and you go through and look at all those prayers, during difficult times, when you pick up that prayer box and you open up and look at the various prayers in the past, it rekindles those, ironically, wonderful memories.
Exactly. I think you see the path of your life, you know, when you look back at those prayers and how they were answered or not answered. And, you know, it's in the looking back that you understand the reasons why.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Okay, the book is available pretty much anywhere books are sold. All the online booksellers and bookstores will either have it on the shelf or they can get it for you. I am pretty easy to find, lisawingate.com, but I also love Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and all those things, so I'm easy to find there, too. I'm sort of an online junkie, which I have to, that's one of the things that fights with the writing sometimes, but I do love to visit with people online, too.
Do you connect with your readers and fans?
I do. You know, one of the most beautiful things about sending, creating these imaginary people and sending them out there in stories is that they come back and they bring real people with them.
Yeah.
And it's there's nothing more beautiful for a writer than hearing from someone who says, you know, this book changed me. This book made me think. This book made me realize I have to accept my family members the way they are. You know, that I can change the way I react to them. I can't change them. I can't make them change. But I can change the way I react. You know, I mean, that's just, it's incredible because you write a story and you think it's about one thing and somebody else reads it and they combine their own life experiences with it and it becomes about something completely different that you didn't imagine. And so I love connecting with readers because that's where you find out what somebody else took from the book.
So true, because everyone has a personalized perspective.
Exactly.
How has writing the prayer box impacted you personally?
I think it has reaffirmed for me the value of regular prayer, the value of praying, and not just praying, but the value of praying and letting go. And one of the things about writers is that we do like to control things. That's why we're writers, because we can control our little universes within the story. And the prayer box and, you know, Iola's character and what's in her letters reaffirms for me, you know, that you have to learn to give things over and let them go, and you, the more regularly you can do that and the more you can make that the habit of your life, the better your life is.
Interesting. What is next for you?
The next book to come out is actually the follow-up to The Prayer Box. Well, there's a novella mm-hmm. coming out in July that's a follow-up, and then there's a book coming out in September. The Story Keeper is the September book, and it's connected to The Prayer Box. There's a series of three that are these Carolina journey mm-hmm. books set out in North Carolina, and so the second one of those is, it's done, it's written, it's in the editing process, and it will come out in September, and the great thing about that is that will take me back out to North Carolina on book tour, so I'm so excited to get to go back and see all my friends on the Outer Banks and spend time there again. If you set books in great places, the wonderful
yeah.
thing is you get to go
right.
there.
Then you need to have some connections in Hawaii, see?
I know. That's a place I'd love to go. I may have to set some books there.
That's right. Prayer Box Part 2.
There you go.
Somehow this box was thrown into the ocean and it floats out all the way over there, you know.
There you go. That might work.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
I would. My recipe for living was actually in my very first book, because the grandmother character in my very first book told my grandmother stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, at one point she's asked in there something my grandmother was asked, what is your key to a long life? Mm-hmm. And my grandmother said, which is my recipe for a good life, and she said, I can't tell you the key to a long life, but I know the key to a good life. And the key to a good life is not in getting what you want, but in learning to want what you get.
Mm.
And to me, there's
beautiful.
Such wisdom in that.
Yeah. That is truly
so,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really, really beautiful. Any final thoughts about The Prayer Box?
I don't know. It's been such a journey for me with this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my final thought about it is that, and really about all my books, is that I hope it motivates people to share their own stories, because you don't know what your story could mean to somebody, what
mm-hmm.
it could create in somebody, what it could teach someone. You know, we tend to sometimes think of our own lives as very ordinary, or I don't have anything to tell people. And I'll say that sometimes to a group of women, and then I'll have them share something from their own lives. And, you know, these amazing, rich, beautiful, teachable, graceful stories come out. And so I guess that's my takeaway,
mm-hmm.
or that's my hope. Is that
yeah.
the book inspires people to share their own stories.
Wonderful. Lisa, thank you for the great recipe for living that you shared with us just now, and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Kathy Curran. Kathy is a lifestyle and communication expert, speaker, and host of Holistic Children's Radio. Kathy and I will be discussing her latest book, Me Plus You. The book is an interactive journal series which helps people communicate in their own unique way. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Lisa, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.